Welcome back to Radio Times. William H. Gray, an influential and much admired political leader, died yesterday in London. He was 71 years old. William Gray was pastor of Bright Hope Baptist Church in North Philadelphia, served in the U.S. Congress, representing Pennsylvania's 2nd Congressional District, and was the president and chief executive of the United Negro College Fund. We asked Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter to join us to remember William H. Gray. And Mayor Nutter, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Margaret. Thanks for taking the time to honor the life and legacy of Bill Gray.
No, absolutely. You're quoted as saying that you were stunned, saddened, and hurt by the news of his sudden death. What has he meant to Philadelphia?
He has meant so much to so many, and as I've said in some other statements, whether it was a guy on the corner or an international leader, Bill Gray had the ability to walk in so many different communities, to communicate with people at such a human level. His passion and commitment certainly to his congregants and folks in the 2nd Congressional District, but even beyond. He was always a go-to person, whether it was his issue or not. Bill Gray cared about people first, and his work, through the 70s and the Black Political Forum, creating progressive black politics, and ultimately cross-racial, multiracial coalition politics. His partnership with George Ross, who unfortunately passed away not too long ago, and creating Operation Understanding, improving relations between the African-American community and the Jewish community. So powerful a relationship through the 50s and 60s in the Civil Rights Movement. But his leadership in the Congress, rising to be, of course, whip and budget chair, he utilized power in the best sense of the word and for all the right reasons to get things done. And he could be, as mentioned in some other comments, I mean, just totally charming, regardless of who he was dealing with, but Bill Gray could play hardball with the best of them. And he enjoyed life, he enjoyed working with people. He worked, he had been working on behalf of the city. I was with him about a month or so ago. He arranged a series of meetings for us and was constantly talking to members of Congress and business leaders on behalf of the city. My chief of staff literally just talked to him one day last week. So it is stunning. And so many of us, regardless of political persuasion or race or gender, certainly starting with myself, our political careers to Bill Gray. When he supported a candidate, he went all out. It was his time, resources, focus, and attention, but a real organized effort. And so many owe so much to this one man. And it just shows you the power of what a person can do when they're focused, when they're engaged, when they're involved. The corporate community, when Bill Gray came out of Congress, the corporate leaders, he had to turn down offers to be on different boards. The work that he did at the United Negro College Fund, having raised more money than had ever been raised before, to send, again, students off to colleges and universities. It's just incredible. And, he's just deeply appreciated, loved, admired, and sorely missed.
Well, and he was the pastor, as we know, of Bright Hope Baptist Church, the third of a number of Grays who were pastor of that church, a very important church in this city.
Oh, no question. Bright Hope Baptist Church, and certainly I talked to Pastor Kevin Johnson, who is the pastor there now, just last night. Bright Hope Baptist Church was often the meeting place. It was not only a place of worship, but it is also a place of action in the community. And so, again, whenever any national or international leader would come to town, often they would be at Bright Hope Baptist Church. Bill Gray, Reverend Gray, was also he was a great preacher. And he could deliver a message, and he was not subtle. He didn't beat around the bush, just called it as he saw it. As we say in the Baptist tradition, at least, you got the word from Bill Gray, and then went out to either do the Lord's work or your own work, but you were going to do some work. You know, he was not a guy, you know, kind of just sitting back giving orders. You know, Bill Gray talked to people, got on the phone, stuffed envelopes. He did, you know, whatever needed to be done. He was a great campaigner, but also an admired leader. And I think you'll hear all kinds of folks across the country talking about him. And I just met, when I was with him not too long ago, I met a couple of his former colleagues, Congressman Gephardt and a U.S. senator, and they talked about the old days and how they got things done. Senator Tom Daschle, we were with him as well. Vernon Jordan. I mean, Bill Gray knew everybody. Or everybody wanted to know Bill Gray. So, you know, it was his level of access was just astounding. And spending a day with him was a little bit of walking through living history.
He was apparently in London at Wimbledon to watch the tennis. Did you ever play tennis with him?
I was smart enough never to play tennis.
He was a good player.
He was a very good player. And as aggressive as he was in politics, he was just that aggressive on the tennis court. So, you know, I think people should know their limitations. I never played tennis with Bill Gray. But he loved the game and loved seeing the game and often went to Wimbledon. His sons apparently were there with him, but he loved life, and he loved doing things. When I was with him about a month ago, he talked about enjoying his family, enjoyed going places. He was taking care of himself, and just, you know, that's why, again, this is so stunning to have had those recent conversations, to know the things that were important to him and what was on his mind, to now try to come to the realization that we won't have him anymore. But what a life led, and what a legacy, something not only to be admired, but I think more importantly, to be emulated. If any of us, you know, reach the heights that he scaled and developed the reputation as well as the outcomes that Bill Gray put forward, any one of us, if we did a tenth of that, we'd be lucky.
Well, Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So
you're welcome. Again, remembering William H. Gray, very influential, much admired political leader, died yesterday in London at the age of 71. Well, Jerome Groopman's book, How Doctors Think, written several years ago, explored how medical decisions are made, how those decisions affect health outcomes, and their impact on the doctor-patient relationship. Our guest, Danielle Ofri, has written about a different aspect of medicine in her new book. It's called What Doctors Feel. It's about her own experiences as an internist at New York's Bellevue Hospital and the reactions of other physicians dealing with the joys and rewards of the profession. It's also about the emotional toll that it can take on them, including the fears of making a mistake, the grief when a patient dies, the frustration of dealing with difficult patients, and the all importance of empathy. Danielle Ofri is an associate professor of medicine at New York University School of Medicine. She's also editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review, joining us from the NPR studios in New York. And Danielle Ofri, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You know, reading your book and even thinking about your book and being a patient and not a doctor, I was thinking that most patients focus on what a doctor thinks rather than how he or she feels. And reading your book, I got the feeling that we should think about what doctors are thinking and also what they are feeling, the importance of both of those conditions.
You know, if you were to type in your symptoms to a computer, you could probably get a diagnosis spit out, perhaps accurate, but I don't think most of us would feel particularly cared for or taken care of, and I think most of us wouldn't want that. I think we all prefer a human being, a real doctor, a real nurse, and with that, that's a human interaction. There's always an underlying of emotions, no matter how you slice it.
But do you think the training of doctors and even the system that we have that doctors operate in, do they take emotions seriously?
It's not a high priority. And one of the things I've noticed with medical students, they come in with all the right stuff. They're idealistic, committed. They come into medicine for all the right reasons. But when they finish their medical training, often that idealism is quite battered. And when research drills into where this takes place, it seems to happen in the third year of medical school, when the students leave the classroom and enter the clinical wards. It's kind of counterintuitive. You might think that's where there'd be the flowering of your commitment. But in fact, the reality of medical care and what students observe on the wards often stamps out a lot of the empathy and emotion they came in with.
What are they seeing that's stamping out that empathy?
Well, when they're in the classroom, they hear all the right lectures with all the right things, commitment, compassion, caring, professionalism. But then they witness how doctors actually behave. And often, it does not reach the ideals that they were taught. Doctors are often very abrupt, disrespectful to patients, to nurses, other staff. Doctors may be consumed with their own issues. They witness doctors berating their underlings, shaming people who make mistakes. So they see what we call the hidden curriculum. What's in the actualities of day-to-day medicine, and often dispenses with a lot of the niceties they learned about.
Reading your book, the feeling I get, and you talk about a lot of different emotions beyond even empathy, I got the feeling that fear is, if not the most dominant emotion, among the most dominant emotions. Fear.
Fear is always present in medicine. And to some degree, I think it should be. I mean, one should have a certain amount of fear when you approach another human being with a knife or a toxic medication or something that can change their life. I mean, the stakes are so much higher than if you mess up with an accounting error. So I think we should all have a certain amount of respectful fear. And I think if we lose that fear, we become cavalier cowboys and better suited to a desk job. But the question is, what happens when fear overwhelms? And certainly, doctors in training at the beginning, fear can certainly overwhelm, and I recall many of those times. And I think if you ask anyone in medicine, they will tell you times, and you may not want to hear them, when fear overwhelmed them.
Well, and we're about a minute away from our first break here. Can you give us an example from your career?
When I was a third-year resident, the first time I was running a cardiac arrest. And at that moment, suddenly my mind went blank. I couldn't remember a single thing. And here's a patient, in the throes of death, and EKGs are going by, and my mind, melted down to nothing. And I couldn't even read the EKG. And in the end, what I thought was the diagnosis was in fact correct, but I was too afraid to say it because I thought I might make an error.
So your ability to make a decision was impeded, I guess, by this overwhelming fear?
Even when I knew the right thing for the patient. And luckily, someone came to my assistance and also taught me the lesson that when we are overwhelmed by fear, that's when we turn to colleagues and not try to, go through it ourselves.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Again, our guest is Danielle Ofri. We're talking about her new book. It's titled What Doctors Feel, and it's subtitled How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. She is, as I said, associate professor of medicine at New York University School of Medicine, practices internal medicine at Bellevue Hospital, editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Chestnut Hill College School of Continuing and Professional Studies offers bachelor's and associate's degrees. Classes are scheduled on weekends and in the evenings with working professionals in mind to allow students to pursue a degree and a new career without putting the rest of their life on hold. Chestnut Hill College is holding an information session on Thursday, July 11th. Details online at chc.edu/visit. Chestnut Hill College is a proud supporter of WHYY.
This July 4th, the stars come out to celebrate America's biggest birthday party at Capitol 4th 2013. Join me, Corva Coleman, and onstage host Tom Bergeron to hear the legendary Barry Manilow, plus special guest Neil Diamond, the National Symphony Orchestra, and more. Live from the U.S. Capitol, don't miss a Capitol 4th 2013 from NPR Music.
Thursday night at 8 on WHYY.
Paul Feig, the director of Bridesmaids, has teamed up with Parks and Recreation writer Katie Dippold to make The Heat, a new buddy cop comedy starring Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy.
I am a federal agent.
What are those?
They're Spanx. They're Spanx. They just hold everything together.
Why? What's going to come popping out?
The director and writer of The Heat, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Danielle Ofri is our guest. She's a physician and author of a new book called What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. We'd love to hear from doctors and from patients. I guess that's just about everybody at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I have to say that the doctors that I know, one of their dominant emotions is just plain old frustration. And in many ways, frustration with our current healthcare system that seems to make it so difficult to be a doctor.
I think that's increasingly true. In fact, today I have an article with Time Magazine's website about the disillusionment of doctors. And in surveys, a majority of doctors look at medicine now in a negative light. And a lot of that comes from how difficult it has become to practice medicine. I mean, paperwork is multiplying and various mandates and rules and restrictions that make it so hard. But the 15-minute visit hasn't gotten any longer, so many of us feel that we're stuck in a position that makes it difficult. On the other hand, though, when asked what is the most important thing about medicine that they enjoy, nearly every doctor says the doctor-patient relationship. So I think that people still have the right motivation, but the logistics of medicine are getting challenging.
But that's really difficult. If the thing that you most care about is the doctor-patient relationship, but you feel like you have 5 minutes to cram in a 15-minute doctor's appointment, that's just a recipe for frustration.
It is, for patients as well. I think patients feel that their doctors are increasingly distracted. They're typing into a computer the whole time. They barely have time to look at them, talk, examine them. It does make it hard, but we do have to face the challenges. And there are ways. For example, I try to tell my students for the first 2 minutes of the interview, look directly at the patient. Don't write. Don't look away. And you'd be surprised how long 2 minutes is when you're focusing directly on someone and really listening hard to their words. And I think that patients do pick up on that.
Time management.
I mean, time management.
In minute increments, time management. But I mean, I can understand how that would work, where you feel like the doctor, instead of looking through their computer or through a chart, is looking at you.
It's very important. The other place I find that I connect much more with a patient now is during the physical exam, because once we get to the exam table, we're away from the computer, and now we're just two human beings touching, talking directly without any technology in between. And often, that's when patients will say what's really on their mind.
You write a really interesting story about a patient early on in your career who was homeless. Smelled, was dirty, in fact had roaches, I think, sort of climbing in and out of her clothing there. And you honestly felt nauseous and kind of walked away from the patient. And there was a nurse who kind of came in and did something that really taught you something very important about being a physician. What did she do and what did you learn?
Well, I was a first-year medical student, so I knew nothing about medicine, and I was volunteering as a rape crisis counselor, and this was my very first call. And it was a disheveled, homeless woman, quite malodorous, and when the roach came out of her clothes, I couldn't do it. I walked away and hid behind the desk. And then I saw a nurse aide come up. She put her arm around the patient, and she spoke gently to the patient, saying, "Listen, let me give you a hand. We'll get you washed up and some clean clothes. Don't worry, I'll be here for you." And the patient responded and stood up, and I watched the two of them walk down the hall with the nurse aide supporting her, talking to her gently, and I really got my first object lesson in empathy. Mm. This nurse aide was able to transcend the difficult smell, the uncomfortable situation, and really see that this was a person in need and gave of herself. And it reminds me, first of all, that lessons and teachers come in all places. And I remind our students, it's not just your professor, but anyone around can be the teacher. And that every patient, no matter what, really does have a need. It's really our job to get beyond the challenges and get to that basic human need.
I mean, seeing beyond all what this woman looked and smelled like, and seeing her as a human being, a real person in need?
And try to imagine if it were you who had unfortunately ended up in a difficult homeless situation and you smelled bad or didn't speak the language and you had a horrible thing happen to you, you would be desperate for someone to see past the externalities and help you. And I try to remind myself and remind my students mm-hmm. about that.
I mean, that's empathy, yes?
That is empathy. And I think it's when we see it in the most challenging cases, that's when it really counts. It's easy to empathize when there are no challenges. When someone's just like you, it's easy. But when someone is very different or has illnesses that appear self-inflicted, drug addiction, alcoholism, obesity, things that doctors find very distasteful, it's much harder to be empathic.
And do doctors find drug addicts and obese people distasteful?
You can see it. And I've often seen otherwise empathic and professional house staff and residents and students, when they're faced with the alcoholic, with the 500th admission for alcohol overdose, just roll their eyes. Oh, nothing I can do. And I think there's a number of reasons. One is that doctors perceive themselves as a pull-them-up-by-your-bootstraps kind of lot. They work very hard. They're very disciplined. And they feel that with enough gumption, you can overcome anything. So they turn and look at patients and say, well, how come you haven't, taken care of this? Why haven't you solved the problem of your alcohol or stopped eating so much? When, in fact, these conditions are very multifaceted and the role that patients play is part of it, but not all of it. And it can be quite challenging. One of the challenges I often have when I'm on the hospital wards with a new team is I ask the team, who's the most difficult patient on the service? And it's usually someone who's an alcoholic or drug addict. And I say, let's go to that patient and see what we can find. And they're often very hard to talk with. But if you ask someone, tell me a bit about yourself. Tell me where you're from, how you came to America, if they're an immigrant, or tell me your hobby or your passion, something about you. You'd be surprised how even, the most disheveled Bowery alcoholic will suddenly light up when they have something to share about themselves. And then after that, it becomes easier to give medical care.
Do you think it's about compliance, which is that a doctor is telling a patient to do something and for a whole host of reasons they don't do it, they don't take their doctor's advice, and that becomes this built-in frustration?
That's a small part of it, but I think there's an issue of respect. And studies have shown that doctors are very disrespectful to patients who are obese and drug addicts. We look at them in a negative way. We're very angry at them. They seem to waste our time. And I think patients pick up on that. And mm-hmm. so respect is an enormous, has enormous healing capacity, I think. And when patients feel respected, they're much more likely to be able to follow their doctor's suggestions. But it's also the doctor understanding that there's some things that are beyond a patient's control, and you can't hold them responsible for everything. Some things, yes, but there are genetic components, environmental, socioeconomic components that maybe more than one person can handle.
Well, just to underscore what you said, you write in your book, there are unspoken but clear rules for acceptable targets. Drug abusers are okay. Cancer patients are not. Alcoholism and obesity are okay. Miscarriage is not. Schizophrenic and borderline patients, yes. Terminally ill patients, no. And children with cancer, never. I mean, should we be surprised or even shocked that doctors have these feelings about certain kinds of patients?
I think we are surprised, but we shouldn't be. I mean, doctors are human beings, and I think they reflect society. I think society feels the same way. A child with cancer, that's a very tragic situation. Someone who's obese, that person just lacks self-control. And so we look at them very differently. Even if there are components of both of them that are beyond their control, we see these differently.
Does that mean, though, that doctors need to be more trained when it comes to the psychology and even sociology of some of these conditions?
Yes, we need to be on alert when our own emotions impede how we deliver medical care. Because when someone comes in who is an alcoholic or an addict or has AIDS or something we find difficult, they're in equal need of care as when someone comes in with cancer or a terminal illness, something that we find legitimate. Illness is the same for everyone, and people always have needs and are very vulnerable, and we can't let our own emotions make a hierarchy of who's more deserving of our medical care.
Is that what you ask doctors to do? I mean, is to have that conversation with themselves to sort of catch their impulses or their negative reactions?
Well, that's the goal of this book, is that to make us aware of the emotions that are going on nonstop. Even if we don't believe, I'll put that in quotes, in the emotions and the touchy-feely side, they're there anyway, and they are affecting how we treat our patients, and we do need to be aware, because our goal is to give the best care to all of our patients, no matter what the situation.
Do you think doctors, though, don't want to believe they have these emotions, or they just sort of push them aside because they've got a job to do?
Well, doctors, we see ourselves as very rational. We wear the white coat of scientists. We believe in evidence-based medicine, which I, of course, support wholeheartedly. But much of what we do is not based in evidence. It's based on anecdote, history, gut, what we've learned, what we see. And these are very much influenced by how we feel. And I think if you ask a doctor to really think hard, I think they can come up with examples of when they've treated patients differently based on the circumstance and their own emotions.
Well, and I would think that someone who's a general practitioner, kind of on the front lines, I mean, you deal with patients in a certain kind of way. Someone who's a surgeon, who's you know, literally putting their hands into someone's body to try to fix a problem there. It seems to me there are different kinds of psychologies or dynamics at play.
There are absolutely different kinds of psychology. But the basic one is remembering that the patient is the one who has the vulnerability and need, and it's really about them. And when our emotions come into play, we have to be aware of them and see when they're impeding care. And sometimes they will assist care. I mean, when doctors are enthusiastic, when they're not feeling disillusioned, when they're excited about their profession, mostly they do a better job. They will go to more lengths for their patient, and it's important to keep an eye on the positive side, too.
And that's Danielle Ofri. She's a physician, author of a new book called What Doctors Feel, and it's subtitled How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. She's an associate professor of medicine at New York University School of Medicine. She practices internal medicine at Bellevue Hospital, editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review, and she writes for a number of publications, including the New York Times Well blog and the New York Times Science Times section. And again, we're taking calls. We do want to hear from some of the doctors in our audience, if you can connect and understand what it is that we're talking about. That phone number again is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We were talking about the kind of fear that doctors often experience, probably for a lot of very good reasons. But I wonder if there's also irrational fear as well, and the kind of shame that can come if you make a mistake and you know you don't want to admit it, or you're afraid of getting caught, sort of how that can affect a doctor that's, let's say, seeing patients.
You know, the medical error is an enormous field that we're working to solve. I mean, many patients die or harm by medical error. Now, lots of medical errors we can see, but many are near misses or ones that no one sees but the doctor. And most doctors, their gut feeling is to hide an error when it happens. I wrote an op-ed about a patient of mine when I was a resident, and I forgot to check a CAT scan. I missed a bleed in the head of this patient. It was eventually caught, and so the patient wasn't harmed, but I still had made the error, and I felt so ashamed of myself and my shortcomings that I never told anyone. Mm-hmm. I didn't tell the patient, the family, my team, my supervisor, and it could have been an opportunity to figure out where the problem came in, how to prevent that, but I couldn't, because it suddenly made me change who I thought I was. I wasn't the doctor that I thought I was. And I realize now that if someone, a higher up, may have addressed the issue of shame and medical errors, I might have felt more comfortable coming forward.
But did you think you'd get in trouble or you'd get sued? I mean, all the sort of fears of admitting a mistake?
You know, that's all true and all there. But the shame was so much more overpowering. I couldn't even get to the first step of opening my mouth and saying, this is what happened. Mm-hmm. So I think that the emotional part is the largest stumbling block, and the others are clearly there. I mean, malpractice, it would be folly to ignore the issues and concerns about malpractice. But if we do want doctors to come forward and tell the profession where errors are occurring, we have to recognize that it's very humiliating to admit an error when you're a perfectionist, like most doctors are.
Hmm. Because shame is often about who someone is or who they think they are, as opposed to guilt, which is generally about what people do that they wish they hadn't have done.
Right. For guilt, we can make restitution and solve the problem. But shame is very hard to cure.
Let me get, looks like Paul from Marion to join us on Radio Times. And Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Ofri. I was really interested in your comments about and your discussion about drug and alcohol-related stigma. I worked in the harm reduction field for a number of years, and some of my colleagues in New York, one Denise Pione, you may have known, she works for the Department of Health now, we often had conversations about how to train doctors in terms of, and it sounds like it's something that you're interested in and you talk about, but, you know, how to deal with stigmatized populations that are doing behaviors that they don't approve of. And one thing I always thought was the problem that, or I saw that we encountered, was that doctors will only listen to other doctors. Huh. That it's really hard to get them to listen to either, to even people with doctorates, like researchers or nurses. And I kind of wonder, is there some way to get beyond that and get them to like to listen to other voices? Because I think that if they only listen to their own voices, you have a limit as to how much they can learn.
Paul, thanks for the call. Sounds like you want to say something, Danielle Ofri.
I think you've put your finger on one of the key problems, that doctors do not listen well to others. And I've noticed that in my own training. When I was in the ICU as a resident, we had a weekly touchy-feely rounds. It wasn't really called that, but we called it that, with a very well-meaning social worker. And we just didn't take it seriously. But when our own attending in the white coat would talk about some of these deeper issues, then we would listen. Mm. And so I think that these issues of professionalism and overcoming stigma can't be taught in a classroom, certainly not with PowerPoint, but only with supervising doctors who can really show the way. Now, that means getting to the people on top and convincing them that this is very important, and then we need to show it. We need to walk the walk rather than talk the talk.
Well, and I would think wearing that white coat, I mean, it does give someone a lot of power and authority. It would be hard to shed that coat, I would think.
You know, when in the book, I shared a story about Mr. Corello, another drug addict, and it was his 57th admission. The team just rolled their eyes. They simply cut and paste his medical record because it's the same every time. And so I said, let's go to his bedside, thinking, boy, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. And he was the typical drug addict with lots of blackouts and not much to say. But then I thought of a question I'd never asked before. I said, Mr. Corello, can you tell us the precise time that you knew you were an addict? You know, we see patients before illness, after illness, but rarely at the precise moment of transition. And he said, yes, there was a moment. And he described driving up the Henry Hudson Parkway in New York to go to his nephew's birthday. And suddenly he needed a hit. Mm. And he whisked the car around, headed downtown to his dealer. And he said, at that moment, I knew it. It's like God reached out a hand and flicked my car downtown. I've been heading that way ever since. And once he shared that very specific moment, there was silence in the room. All the shuffling had stopped. And I think suddenly we had an insight to what it must feel like when something overcomes you and changes your life. And after that, the team treated the patient so differently. There were no derogatory comments, no more eye rolling. People went into his room more often. He was much more compliant, easy to talk to. And I don't kid myself that we'll solve his drug addiction with that type of encounter. But it's hard to imagine how he would solve it without that.
It's a great question. Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Danielle Ofri about her book called What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. And she is a physician and practices internal medicine at Bellevue Hospital, where she's editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Wheaton Arts in Millville, New Jersey supports WHYY and announces Wheaton Wide Open, featuring daily glassmaking demonstrations and family art activities. No admission tickets required during July. Presented by PNC Arts Alive. Details at wheatonarts.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we look back on the Supreme Court term that ended last week with Adam Liptak, the New York Times Supreme Court correspondent. Liptak says Chief Justice Roberts' patient and methodical approach has allowed him to establish a robustly conservative record. We'll also talk about Liptak's new ebook on the Supreme Court and the battle for same-sex marriage. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Egypt's leader is handed an ultimatum after mounting protests throughout the country. Protesters calling on Mohamed Morsi to go.
Democratically speaking, he should listen to the people as long as democracy is the rule of the people.
Democracy in action or democracy falling apart? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2013 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. More at Lincoln.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Dr. Danielle Ofri about What Doctors Feel, the title of her new book, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Of course, doctors have to deal with grief and loss because of patients whose health takes a turn for the worse or even patients who die. You tell this extraordinary story of a young pediatrician. You call her Eva. And she was there as a baby died shortly after birth. Tell us what she did.
She was an intern, a beginning pediatric intern, and she was called to a delivery room where a teenage couple, very young parents, were delivering a severely deformed baby, that it was known in advance that this baby would not survive. And the parents had said they didn't want to see the baby because the malformations were quite severe. So when the baby came out, she was given the baby and told to take it out of the room. And the only place she could find was a supply closet where she and this baby, who was dying, were squished in there. And her job was to examine the baby and record the time of death. And when you're watching someone, a baby, die, it takes a very, very long time. And as she's looking at this terribly deformed baby who would never be held by its parent, she was so overcome. And she was supposed to leave the baby unwrapped so she could watch the umbilical cord, because the pulsations and the cord are what determine the time of death. But she couldn't bear it. She finally wrapped the baby up, held the baby, and just rocked it, and just said, "I love you, baby. I love you," till the baby died. But then she had the next admission to get to. There wasn't any time to process for what a 20-something-year-old must feel like to hold a baby as it dies in her arms. And her entire residency was like that, traumatic experiences with no time or space to address that. And then later on, it came back as post-traumatic stress disorder. She had flashbacks to these very traumatic moments.
That's such a powerful story. I mean, do you think it was something about her, or is it also something about dealing with such traumatic situations and being, let's say, an ER doctor or something, where you're just moving from one patient to another and with no time to process what's happened?
I don't think it's unique to her. I think it's a human experience. I mean, anyone who holds a dying child in their arms has to be affected. To not be affected would suggest the problem. Unfortunately, our medical system doesn't allow the time and space, and there wasn't a senior doctor said, "Wow, you must have been through quite an experience last night. Do you want to take a few minutes to talk about that?" There was no space. I think there's more attention to it now, but it's still a side thing, a small thing on the side, separate from the main issues of caregiving. But in fact, these are central issues in caregiving.
And you think that would have helped someone just to acknowledge what she had done and what she had gone through and observed with this little baby?
I think it would have. I think every human needs a moment to touch base with someone to reflect on the gravity. How could you not be affected?
You write in this book, and then we'll get back to our callers, several chapters about a patient that you call Julia, clearly a long-term patient of yours, and she had some pretty serious heart problems, and a patient that clearly has meant a lot to you or meant a lot to you.
This patient, Julia, or she goes by Julia, was a young woman in her 30s with a genetic disorder that caused her heart to fail at a young age. And essentially, there was no treatment. There was one treatment, a cure, in fact, and that would be a heart transplant. Mm. But she was an undocumented immigrant from Guatemala, thus could not be on the transplant list. And I actually wrote about her in a previous book about the experience of having to tell her this and how none of us could do it. And many, many doctors tried. All of us could not get out the words because it was clear she would die of this. I wrote about it, actually, for an op-ed in the New York Times, and there were quite scathing letters in response to how we robbed the patient of time. And it's true, we did. But the reason I wrote about it, because it speaks to how much emotion affects how we behave as doctors. We couldn't tell this healthy woman, otherwise healthy woman, that she would die because of her immigration status, not because of something else. And in this new book, I trace her case over many years. She's been my patient for a very long time. Mm. And the ups and downs and all the emotions, sadness, grief, joy, commitment. She was a really special woman. And she gave me the gift of a wide-angle lens and what it's like to have a medical condition with other constraints that act upon it.
Well, and there's so many parts of the story, and the one that you reference, which is just how much do you tell a patient? And I would think that sort of varies from patient to patient. It's hard to have a sort of one-size-fits-all prescription for that.
Correct. I think that patients have a right to know as much or as little as they want, but they really have to decide how much and how they want it. And there will be times when I might ask a patient, how much do you want to know? Because some patients may say, you know what, I don't want the details. Or if it's really bad news, you know, tell my spouse or my child. And if that's the case, a grown child, I mean, that's fine. But otherwise, I think every patient is entitled to the full knowledge so they can plan their life and make decisions. But it's not a one-size-fits-all from the doctor's perspective. We're not just a computer who spits out, you know, the diagnosis and prognosis. Our own issues and own feelings and emotions come into play when we say these very traumatic words.
Let me get, looks like Josh from Wynwood to join us on Radio Times. Josh, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Ofri.
Go ahead, Josh.
Full disclosure, I've known Danielle for many decades.
Okay.
And Danielle, of course, you're just sort of articulate and empathetic person who could achieve the kinds of things you've achieved. And, you know, I think you bring your real specialist, your specialization to medicine, something that you just are, you know, something that you became, you know, as a human being, and that's being a humanist. You know, I don't think you learned that in medical school. And, I wonder whether, I mean, your achievements are you know, really things that you brought to the profession. And I wonder if doctors who don't come to the profession with their own natural capacity of being humanists, and if they don't have the attitude that that's central. I mean, doctors surely need to be scientists, but they're scientists who treat humans, so they need to be humanists as well. And I wonder if that can be taught, and if so, if there's any other way to do it than to weave it through every aspect of their training. I certainly agree that it can't be taught with PowerPoints and it can't be taught in a class by a social worker.
Well, Josh, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Danielle, do you know who Josh is?
Yes, thank you.
Okay,
you got me blushing here.
Okay, go
but
ahead.
I agree that you need things beyond being a scientist. But my sense from the incoming medical students is that they have enough of it. They don't have to be world travelers and be complete Renaissance people, but they have to have the right ideals, and really most of them do. The doctors who wanted to just make money, they've all left and gone to Wall Street. And who's left right now coming into the profession do have the right stuff. I think the job is for us to keep it and preserve it and allow it to flower and not get stamped out by the, you know, the challenges of medical care. And I think that's the job of all the people who are teaching medicine and acting as role models to help give space for that, acknowledge how important it is, offer compliments when you see it, and state how important that is for medical care. So we just have to keep it, not let it go away.
Josh, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You write about Jefferson Medical College here in Philadelphia and something called the Jefferson Scale of Empathy. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Empathy is one of those things that you kind of know it when you see it. But in order to study it, you have to have a way of measuring it. And it's a tricky thing to measure. So at Jefferson, they developed a questionnaire that seems to correlate to how much, how many skills doctors have in empathy. And what's interesting is how the scores in these pan out. So students who score high in empathy in this scale tend to go into primary care professions more than procedure-based professions. They often do very well, you know, on measures of academic success. But what I found most interesting is outcomes. There's been some studies now looking at the outcomes of patients whose doctors score high in empathy scales. Mm-hmm. And for example, in diabetes, those patients have better glucose control and better cholesterol mm-hmm. control. It's really fascinating.
But do you think, I mean, but it sort of makes sense if you think about it, which is that if there's a relationship there and if the patient feels that the doctor cares, giving them that eye contact that you were talking about, perhaps there would be more compliance, for instance.
And in fact, there is more medication compliance. Even the common cold appears to be shorter. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe that the patient feels more secure so they can do the right thing. Maybe they feel respected and trusted, or they know they can ask a question when they need it. It's not clear what are all the elements in that, but patients seem to do better and certainly aren't doing worse. So I think there is validity to measuring empathy and talking about how important it is.
Well, let's get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have Will from Rose Valley joining us on Radio Times. Will, go ahead. You're on the air.
As a patient, I've always made a point of addressing my doctors by their first names, which always seemed to make the relationship more personal. And while no doctor ever seemed offended by it, it was also nothing that ever seemed to be encouraged at the outset. And I was just wondered if this is anything that is encouraged, discouraged, or even addressed during medical training.
Well, that's interesting, Will. What do you think, Danielle?
Well, actually, there is a very explicit rule about addressing patients, not by their first name. And we tell students over and over, you must address the patient formally. Now, the patient may say, hey, you can call me Joe. That's okay. And I think the same goes both ways. Most patients, I find, call me by my last name. But if you use my first name and I let it go, but I call them by their first name with their honorific, unless they say, call me by my first name. And then it's very comfortable. But I want to do what makes the patient feel the most comfortable.
But the idea is they're Mr. or Mrs. or Ms. and your doctor.
Right. Unless they say it's okay to use my first name. And I don't mind being called by my first name. I've been called worse.
Will, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm curious, what kind of patient are you? Because I think doctors have a reputation, rightly or wrongly, for being notoriously bad patients.
Well, I think most doctors just don't want to be patients, and we try our best not to be. I mean, generally, doctors are a healthy lot, but we age and we get sick. My most interesting learning experience was when I had my baby in my own hospital. Right. And I remember after, you know, in modern obstetrics, they starve you until you produce a baby. So when you finally get to the recovery room, they put down this beautiful frosty pitcher of ice water, and that's all I wanted in the world. But it was just out of reach, and I couldn't just hop up and get it. And I suddenly understood what these, quote, small things mean for patients. I could not reach that water. And I remember calling and waiting and trying to lasso with my pillow. And it makes me now, when I see a patient, I'm always arranging their bedside table to put the phone and the water closer. So I think that doctors can be challenging patients. I'm always trying to ask for the medical background. But at some point, you know, my third child, I gave birth in Costa Rica on sabbatical. And it was very interesting to be doing medical care in my second language. And it's one thing to speak Spanish when I'm chatting outside. It's another thing when you're in labor, trying to conjugate verbs is very hard. And I realized that I just couldn't do it. I was just too vulnerable and too exhausted. And I really just had to sit back and rely on my doctors and nurses to take care of me. And that was another very interesting lesson.
Let me get Diane from, looks like Lansdale, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Diane. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Hi. I'm an advanced practice psychiatric nurse and very active in the American Psychiatric Nurses Association. I teach psychiatric nursing to nursing students and have for over 30 years. And one of the comments I wanted to make was, if we would like to increase empathy in our medical students and other healthcare professionals, we need to stop labeling our patients as schizophrenic, diabetic, addicts. Those are really negative connotations about people. These are human beings who happen to have serious biological illnesses. And I think there's a lot of discrimination and stigma, especially towards patients who have more designated DSM diagnosis. So I'd like to hear what the speaker has to say about that. And also, there is a big focus now on integration of mental health into primary care and into the hospital settings. And I think maybe that will really help to share our experience, our knowledge base. And there is a lot more in terms of neuroscience, in terms of interactions and relationships with patients, that it actually changes the nervous system. It changes the brain, and it actually creates a healing ability within the brain.
Well, Diane, I appreciate the call. No, I think you raised some really good points. I want to give our guests a chance to respond, especially to the labeling issue. What do you think?
I wholeheartedly agree. It's a definite problem of medicine. Sometimes people will talk about a cancer patient, Mr. Jones failed chemotherapy, and I stop the resident and say, did they fail chemotherapy or did chemotherapy fail them? It's really how we speak and label patients that I think does offer a lot of negative attitude and stigma. And so I wholeheartedly agree that we should refer to people as someone with an illness, not the illness themselves.
I'd be curious about the response to your book. Is it too soon to tell?
Well, I've got a lot of interesting responses. I think people are very intrigued, partly because healthcare is something that we can't avoid. You might go through life and never have to see an accountant or a plumber or a ceiling tiler, but you're not going to make it through life without interacting with the medical profession. If not for you, then your child or aging parent. So there's quite a universal, I think, fear of medicine and the fear of the vulnerability that even if you're smart, wealthy, and connected, when you become sick, all of that goes to the wayside and it is very vulnerable. So I think people are intrigued by their doctors and how they respond, and I hope that both patients and doctors will read it and realize that emotions are part of the doctor-patient connection.
And would that be a revolutionary idea in medical schools today?
I think it would be. There is some attention, but it's largely lip service now. We look at it as the touchy-feely side. But I think if you talk to patients, instinctively know the difference between being cured and being healed, whereas doctors don't always get it. Mm. And again, a patient can be cured by the right medicine but not feel healed if they don't have the experience of being cared for.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Danielle Ofri, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's Associate Professor of Medicine at New York University School of Medicine, practices internal medicine at Bellevue Hospital, where she's Editor-in-Chief of the Bellevue Literary Review, author of a new book called What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can get information about podcasts of the show, Facebook, Twitter, archives, email, satellite radio. Nick Sessler, our intern for today's edition of Radio Times, Kevin Griffin, our engineer. The program is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder with Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.